This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 20th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week, normality is resumed after our summer series. We were going to call it a holiday, but that hasn't quite happened yet. Nonetheless, we're bursting with questions to be answered, and the one we're attempting to top and tail this week is, how do you appreciate sound art? You know the sort of thing. Perhaps you go to a gallery, maybe it's the Turner Prize, and you walk into a space with no pictures on the walls, just some speakers playing something. Is it music? Is it the soundtrack to a film that you're meant to imagine? Or is it something that can only make sense when appreciated by the ears? We'll speak to artists, curators, the uninitiated and the professionals to get a handle on sound art. Will it ever be as easy to love as painting or as voguish as performance art? How do you make it? Where do you house it? And how do you sell it? Sam Bell-Infante is a sound artist and one of our voices today.
There is a growing market for sound. If you just look at people like Haroon Mirza, Christian Markley, etc. And actually, it's the commercial sector, I'd say, that's increasingly stepping forward.
So there we go. It's all set up. How do you appreciate sound art? It's the question we're going to be answering on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. My guest today is artist Sam Bell-Infante, a London-based artist and curator. He's recently curated a show that's been toured around the UK by the Hayward Gallery called Listening. The exhibition investigates the act of listening in contemporary visual art and brings together works by the likes of Christian Markley, Haroon Mirza and Janet Cardiff. A pretty decent fit for a show like this. Sam is the perfect guest. Welcome to the show, Sam. And this is the thing, we're kicking off, we're asking, how do you appreciate sound art? Does the definition or does the name sound art, does it help or hinder the stuff that comes under that umbrella, I wonder?
The answer is both, I suppose. Specifically, my listening exhibition has come from trying to move a little bit away from that definition, because I think sound art has been really important in terms of, you know, foregrounding a particular type of practice, but it risks further ghettoising those practices, especially in relationship to the gallery. So there's two primary ways historically sound art has been shown: either a black box room where you go in and you listen to sound and you go out and you go into another one, and they're all in discrete kind of
listening booths.
Yeah, and then the other way is you just fire it all off and make a kind of mega mix, which was done in a very exciting way by David Toop in 2001 at the Hayward the Sonic Boom exhibition, which I suppose is very much the kind of lineage which I'm working on. But my idea of listening is to not just think about sound, but think about listening and how it folds into and across all the senses.
I always think maybe there's two ways of art jumping from a diving board into a larger ocean. One is really good writers writing about it and making it accessible. Critics maybe, but writers, you know, people just liking stuff. Presumably that's very important to the stuff we're talking about today, to sound art.
Yes, but again, like sound art as a genre, it can be really kind of paralyzing as well, because, you know, the biggest field now, you know, the biggest emerging field is sound art studies in all the major universities across the world. Now we've got sound art, it's in the canon of stuff, but it's this kind of constantly emerging, constantly new. I suppose a bit like sound has got this idea of something that's constantly emerging, it's never fully there, and it's
always just an echo.
Yeah, exactly, it's just kind of on the edge of being present. So studies are like that as well, and a big part of what I'm trying to do is I don't know, hybrid forms or thinking about not completely throwing a gallery out, for instance, like, because, you know, the gallery is still incredibly important for practitioners within fine art. So listening as an exhibition is about how, you know, sound can coexist with all these other different forms. And one big approach in listening was to borrow techniques and methodologies from theatre and from other places. So, for instance, the gallery is built for, you know, paintings on the wall, for visual appreciation of things. You know, even now,
just not geared towards sound art.
Yeah, yeah. So even you go to the top institutions, you know, the Tate, the Hayward, these places, and they can still be a little bit scared of sound because it bleeds all over the place. It goes through the walls.
Yeah. So I suppose these institutions, these galleries, whether they're commercial, whether they're public, are maybe scared of sound. Do you think the public are less scared of sound than the institutions in which the public might see these or hear these exhibitions? Do you think the public are perhaps less terrified than the curators of some of the national galleries?
100%. Because one myth myth is this idea that it's the arts audiences that are always really open and they go to a concert, they go to this. But actually, the Arts Council did a study. The regular concert goer is much more likely to say, I'm going to go to the Tate or I'm going to go and see a visual exhibition. Whereas people who would identify themselves as art lovers are much less likely to go and see an opera, go to the ballet. The problem is more in terms of the institutions, the curators, etc., in terms of the way they've got to organise their kind of institutions.
And we've talked about writers being some of the people that can maybe open up this field to people understanding and having the confidence to say, I like this, I don't like this, rather than feeling like they have to study it. Another way, presumably, is the commercial side of it. How strong is the market for sound art?
There is a growing market for sound. If you just look at people like Haroon Mirza and Christian Markley, etc. And actually, it's the commercial sector, I'd say, that's increasingly stepping forward to support this kind of practice. Like Christian Markley had a recent amazing show, The White Cube. And the sad thing is, I sometimes think, could that happen at a publicly funded institution now? I'm not sure it could, the way funding is going, because it's often the public programmes and live programmes that is the first to go. But also monetizing performance is quite difficult. I think something like Tino Segal, or this idea that there is no object. The impermanence of sound is what makes it so interesting and alluring to artists.
It's a bit like video art. I mean, you know, most video art, you get a DVD, you know, when you buy something. You know, it might be Bill Viola, who's also a sound artist, I suppose. But essentially, you get a DVD. Maybe people are... The artifact, I suppose, is, in this case, very ethereal, isn't it? But nonetheless, I guess the market... It's nice to hear that the market is responding where perhaps public bodies are doing less so.
But sound is part of a body of work, and I think this is part of this idea of the sound art. It makes you think of some guy, you know, with headphones on, like, doing their thing. But actually, a lot of the artists, for instance, I'm interested in my exhibition, that's part of a wider practice, in the same way they might use film or video or paint. I think a lot of the artists aren't really worried about zooming into one particular media. They're actually a lot freer and moving around in quite a natural way.
And just finally, Sam, do you see sometimes your show Listening, that's been touring around and is touring still, is a great example of why people shouldn't be scared of sound. But do you see why people are?
Yes, I do. And maybe it's a fear of things colliding and overlapping and bleeding into one of each other. An exhibition with sound requires a good deal of collaboration with the artist, because unless you have a load of anechoic chambers, there are going to be kind of conversations and overlaps of works.
There might just be happy accidents.
Exactly. But but I think if you as an artist, curator, whatever, really engage with that in the way you would in a music festival or a circus, or if you engage with it in a different kind of way, it can be really exciting. We're always listening. That's the thing. You know, it's one of the senses that we don't ever never switch off. You know, there's no ear lids. So, you know, I think it's in some ways a very natural thing that we don't have to prepare ourselves in a special way to experience it.
Nice. Well, Sam Belenfante, thank you very much indeed. You're brilliant at talking about it. Unironically enough, the exhibition is called Listening, and it is touring around at the moment. You can check that out. Sam Belenfante, by the way, is BelinFante. So people can Google it. They want to see this show or hear it, should I say. Thank you very much, Sam. The National Gallery stands grandly in London's Trafalgar Square, housing over 2,000 of Europe's finest and most famous paintings. It's a great attraction for both art lovers and tourists, but the institution is facing a similar problem to others of its size. How do you keep young people and new people interested in learning about these masterpieces, and how do you keep the front doors revolving? Why are we talking about it? Because the National Gallery's summer exhibition is called Soundscapes. Producer Holly headed over to see how this sonic show might reinvigorate the average punter's relationship with some of these famous paintings.
If you head down to the National Gallery's basement today, you'll find their summer show, which is hoping to intrigue regulars as well as draw in a new crowd. It's called Soundscapes and consists of six works by artists who were asked to choose one of the gallery's paintings and replicate their interpretation of it in sound. Minna Moore-Ead is the curator of the exhibition. She explains the idea behind Soundscapes.
When you put a contemporary lens on old master art. You get a wonderful revitalization, if you like, of those paintings. I think it's helpful for our younger audience to think of new ways of looking at those works. The idea of installing only one painting per room is really in order that the public might be encouraged through sound to dwell in the space and to really look, because we do struggle sometimes to get people to dwell and to look for any length of time at pictures.
So in we go. The show is split into six cool dark rooms. Each one contains a spotlit painting and its corresponding composition. Meticulous soundproofing has been installed throughout.
I have to say it's been the most complicated show I've ever worked on at my time at the National Gallery. We thought that it would work better to go for a diverse group of sound artists and musicians. So we invited two from the sound art world, and that's Susan Phillips and the Canadian duo, sound artists Janet Cardiff and George Burrs-Miller. Then we invited two from the classical music world, and that's Nico Muley and Gabriel Yared. And then the idea was to extend that reach with the natural sound recordist Chris Watson. And at the other end of the spectrum, the most sort of urban contemporary sound, the young DJ Jamie XX.
The exhibition begins with Chris Watson's piece. Throughout his career, he's recorded the natural environment all around the world for television and radio. This is perhaps the most literal representation of the painting in front of us.
I chose Lake Kaitala by a Finnish painter called Akseli Gallen Kallela. It's a beautiful landscape and waterscape, but also Gallen Kallela captured this particular spirit of place, which is something I'm interested in recording on location, and I felt he'd really captured that in the painting, so I was delighted to try and combine the two.
Commissions like this allow sound recordists like Watson more freedom to create multi-layered 3D sound.
I capture sound in a surround sound at a spatial format and reproduce it in that way, so it puts the audience on the shores of Lake Kaitala. When I stand in the gallery and listen to the work as well as look at the painting, it sounds, it reminds me of standing on the shores of Kielder Water or a Norwegian fjord. When I made those original recordings, that there's a fidelity to it which is quite remarkable.
As you move through the exhibition, it's interesting to see how people interact with the paintings. Hans Holbein the Younger's The Ambassadors is a popular attraction in the National Gallery, as people peer into the painting to see the anamorphic skull. But in this exhibition, the audience sits politely on benches at the back of the room, taking in the size of the painting and Susan Phillips' sparse composition. In the third room, Janet Cardiff and George Burrs-Miller haven't only designed a soundscape of what they thought might be heard by St. Jerome in his study, but they've extended the painting into a large model of his house, adding another dimension to this already 3D show. The final room contains Jamie XX's take on Theo van Rijsselberghe's coastal scene. The pointillist painting is represented by modern beats that the producer is famous for. Here the crowd seems to relax and dares to discuss the works they have seen and heard. As Minna Ede Moore said earlier, one of the main ideas behind the exhibition is to make people look for longer.
One of the aims behind this project is to try and open up the paintings in a different way. This is an opportunity to literally and metaphorically open up new channels to National Gallery paintings. You don't need to know anything when you come, but the musician has thought long and hard about the piece of music that they have composed in response. And the wonderful thing about music is that it does encourage you to feel something and to respond. And as well as that, because music is a time-based medium, the sound and the music, they do guide you in your looking. They encourage you to look around the painting for a duration, for a period of time that you might not do if you were upstairs. Whether you like paintings to be heard with sound is a personal decision, but the aim of the show is that you can experience the two together and that the one will somehow enhance the other.
While you could argue that hearing someone else's interpretation of a painting might influence your take on it, these pieces do make the audience stop, look, and listen. And the crowd in soundscapes certainly moves more slowly than those upstairs. The National Gallery won't be adopting this idea throughout their collection, but it's an interesting experiment in how sound can be used to attract, engage, and challenge an audience. For Monocon in London, I'm Holly Fisher.
Thanks, Holly. After the break, we'll find out how you display sound art in a gallery, and we'll jump on a train for an hour-old journey through southeast England.
Choo-choo! Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. How do you display sound art or even music in an art context, in a gallery, a museum, a biennial? Is just the sound enough, or should the curator team the auditory with something visual or follow the all-pervasive trend for performance? In Berlin, Monocle contributor Kimberly Bradley met Clara Meister, a young German curator who often works with sound artists and music as art, to discuss the possibilities.
Berlin's IFA Gallery is a state-run platform for dialogues between people and cultures. At an exhibition called Carrefour Meeting Point, a mysterious pedestal is on view. Open its lid, and sounds resound from within. It's the physical manifestation of Meister's music sound art project at last year's Marrakesh Biennial. But beyond the object, how can the auditory transform an art space? And what's the difference between sound art and music as art?
There's a huge difference between sound art and exhibiting music in the context of art. To me, they open different aspects of the questions that already lie in music and all ephemeral mediums. To me, with sound art, it often has more, like it triggers more the question of the spatial aspect of sound or even more abstract questions of sound. If you exhibit music, or at least how I deal with it, it's much more about where people meet, what it actually moves in the people.
Presenting sound art or music as art in a museum or gallery has much to do with context. Meister's interested in exploring exactly that.
If you just take this very simple example, you can think about we are in a museum, you're in front of an image, and you look at it very, very concentrated because you think you're in a museum. There's a context of art, so there's something to understand. And what I'm trying to see is if we can take this attention or this certain seriousness of contextualizing and conceptualizing ideas into music. So what happens if people meet music in a space of art? How do they encounter it?
It doesn't have to include the visual, but it can, which brings us back to the pedestal in the gallery. Curator Alia Septi asked Clara Meister and the Berlin architecture collective STIFF to visually display their Marrakesh Biennial project, where Meister worked with local musicians who sang and walked between visual art venues. It wasn't easy.
And I was completely overwhelmed. I was like, how do I actually show something that is A, not visible, which is music, and B, which is already past? We documented all the performances, we recorded everything and photographed everything, and then for the show here, I decided together with the architecture group STIFF, with whom I also worked on the architecture research in Marrakesh, to work on something which is like a music box. So the object you can actually imagine looks like a pedestal, an empty pedestal, which I also find very interesting symbolically because there's nothing to see, which you can open like a music box, and once you open it, you release the music, you activate the music.
This brings up performance, a big current trend across the art world, but also in sound and music. This has a tradition. Just think of John Cage. But these days it reflects a longing to experience something live.
Now I have the feeling that there's more and more performative aspects coming into the art world again. it was never lost, but I have the feeling also at art fairs and museums, there's a lot of formats with performative works.
At the same time, more traditional modes of presenting sound art, perhaps an empty room with speakers, are still present and valid.
Sound, as there are no borders to sound, and as it's not only three-dimensional, but it's like omnidimensional in the space, like it goes into all the corners and so on and so on. So it's so interesting to work with sound under the spatial aspects, to understand a space through sound.
The omnidirectionality makes presenting sound art and music as art more flexible than presenting an object in a room. In Marrakesh last year, for example, some sound art pieces ran in selected taxi cabs, no matter who was in them. Others were solitary works in huge exhibition spaces. As important as context and location is, sound also breaks the boundaries of the dedicated art space, which is part of its fascination.
I think that is the great thing about sound, because it can be live, it can be inside, it can be outside, it can be in a radio, in a taxi, it can be on headphones and you walk along with them, it can be at home, it can be on a computer, it can be everywhere, it can be filling a space, it can be just coming from a little speaker and you have to go very, very, very close so you don't miss any moment. So, I mean, I can't talk about all these formats. I think we need another hour for this. I think that's the wonderful, great thing also about recorded sound.
On opening night at IFA, a live performer jammed with recorded sounds, mixing modes, and living out sound's many facets. For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
Thanks, Kim, and Carrefour runs all summer until the 4th of October. Sonorama, a new work by composer Claudia Molitor, has transformed one train journey into a work of sound art. The work is not merely a soundtrack for the weary commuter, however, rather it allows us to explore the landscapes hurtling past us in unexpected ways. Simon Tarek takes the high-speed Southeastern from King's Cross to Margate to listen to the view from the train. You heard me right. Listen to the view.
We will shortly be arriving at Margate.
I was commuting a lot on long distance journeys, and I find it really an interesting place to actually think, because it's a place where you can kind of completely get out of your normal way of doing things. You're sort of trapped in this train, you can't really go anywhere, and you can just stare out of the window and let your thoughts run, and that's kind of very freeing.
Claudia Molitor is speaking to me over a coffee at the British Library. The composer and artist has been here a lot over the last 3 years, working on her new project Sonorama with historian David Hendy and contemporary art organisation Electra. A collection of sound pieces for the otherwise silent view from the train journey between King's Cross and Margate. Sonorama provides new compositions, archival sounds and spoken word essays relating to the social history and present landscape of the route. Involving a wide range of collaborators, including Guardian writer and classicist Charlotte Higgins, saxophonist Evan Parker and poet Lemon Sisse, the work provides a sense of place for each leg of the journey, while complicating the stories from each site that the various sounds correspond to.
I thought, well, what's really interesting is that I'm looking out at this landscape rushing past really quite fast, like a film almost. And I'm sitting in this space that is actually quite static. And there's this real disconnect about what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to make a piece that deals with that disconnect?
To listen is to be straining towards a possible meaning, and consequently one that is not immediately accessible.
I thought of the actual journey as the score, and going up and down it, notating things of particular interest, and then coming to the British Library and going to the map department and looking at old maps from that area and just looking if there's anything that looks interesting and sounds interesting. What's important is not that this is a all-encompassing, didactic thing. It was important to dig out some histories that are unknown. we know quite a lot about the military history of Kent and all those kind of things, but we don't know about so much about the people from East London who came down to Kent for hop picking.
Now hear the rustle of the hops being pushed into the pocket. And now the sound of the press.
It makes a big sound too.
Sonorama was curated and produced by Elektra, an agency that works across sound, moving image, performance and the visual arts. The long and collaborative process entailed in the project is typical of Elektra's spirit, as director Irene Revel explains.
It's a project that fundamentally doesn't fit into any existing structure. It's neither a commission for a concert hall nor for a public art gallery. Also, it had an extensive and quite complex period of development over several years, something which is unusual for a commissioner to commit to, particularly the research side. For us, it's fundamentally important to be able to provide these kinds of opportunities and support for artists or composers whose work doesn't fit so easily into existing structures. The content of the different tracks is varied. It's not one single smooth composition. It certainly isn't a soundtrack for the journey, and that's intentional. You might listen to the whole thing in one go, but you might also rather choose, you know, depending on your mood or what you feel most drawn to at a given moment, to say, listen to the compositions, or just the archival recordings, or just the spoken word essay.
You sort of translated those histories into very beautiful compositions which punctuate the journey, and you end actually in this celebration of immigration is using flutes from India and the Middle East. And in terms of composing for this journey, what were the challenges there?
The way you access is on an app. So obviously the quality of the sound files can't be enormous, otherwise they wouldn't all fit on an app. And then you're listening to it through headphones, and the train is loud and there are announcements. So you have to think of how does what you will be listening relate to those kind of sounds. For 16 kilometers of the journey, you're actually in a tunnel, and that's a very sort of different sound space. So I was very conscious about when those pieces would be listened to and what sounds would be around there. But you can play with these things, and beautiful accidental things happen.
The diverse playlist that encompasses Sonorama not only illuminates the places it digs into, it also interrogates the practice of listening itself, at some points derailing the notion of what can even be defined as sound art. For that reason, it is a train trip worth taking. For Monocle in London, I'm Saima Tarek.
Thanks, Saima, and Sonorama is on until the beginning of November. So there we have it. How do you appreciate sound art? Well, by not being scared of it, by trusting your instincts, is it any good? And perhaps by losing the art suffix completely. Sound has always been good enough for this show. So there. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was, hitting the high notes, Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.